From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
I've been looking a lot for bitter greens lately. It seems like the older I get, the more bitter greens I want.
That's Chef Wes Witzel. He owns Manuela in LA's Arts District. Laura Avery caught up with him at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
What are some examples of tasty bitter greens?
Dandelion is probably my favorite right now. Escarole, mustard greens, spigarello.
And what is it about the bitter greens? They're healthier, do you feel, or what?
There's no doubt about their health, but the taste. They have so much complexity, and you can put hot dressings on them, and they don't wilt, and there's just so much more you can do with them. They're just beautiful.
Are they a braised green? Do you ever eat them raw?
Yeah, we eat them raw. The actually new salad that I'm working on is all bitter greens with sort of a warm vinaigrette, warm chicken, warm croutons. So a little bit of the warmth just wilts them just a little bit, but it still keeps their structure.
People that cook with bitter greens, it seems they're always saying you got to complement or offset or balance the bitterness with
acidity.
Oh, acidity, yeah. Not sweetness necessarily?
Yeah, sweetness works as well. Mm-hmm. Dates do a really good job, but I like to use acidity. I think acidity balances most every dish. So the vinaigrette I'm making now, whole grain mustard, a little Dijon red wine vinegar, and a touch of honey as well. So it adds the acidity and a little bit of hint of sweetness as well, which balances that bitterness.
And how many greens would you combine in one dish?
Just take, for example, this salad that I'm working on now. It's going to have treviso, radicchio, endive, mustard greens, and rapini leaves. But when you add everything else to it, the almonds, the crouton, the chicken, the red bell pepper, and then that sort of sweet, acidic dressing, it's a really nice mixture for a salad.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the endive.
I'm doing an endive salad right now that's just the whole leaves with cheese and croutons and red walnuts and an orange vinaigrette, which you have to eat it with your hands. You can't get a fork in there. It's just going to go all over the place. We stack it up. You get in there, you grab it.
That sounds wonderful.
Never eaten salad with your hands?
No.
Jesus. You got to come to Manuela.
Well,
and I got chickens in the backyard.
Okay, well, that's all good. That's all super good. That's for the backyard, the freshness, the grow your own.
Yep, all that's happening in Manuela. We got bees coming as well. We're going to make our own honey. Mm-hmm. Most of the eggs we get from Peter Shaner, but we also got the chickens from him too, so they're laying the eggs.
Is there a garden behind the restaurant in the Arts District?
We have about 1,200 square foot of growing space, raised beds. Yeah, if I can grow all of my herbs, I'm going to be happy. And that's kind of the goal at this point.
All right, Wes, well, thank you so much. This is a great, healthy, bracing way to start the new year. Appreciate all the information.
Of course, my pleasure.
That was Wes Witzel. He is chef owner of Manuela. It's located in the art gallery Hauserwerth and Schimmel down in the Arts District. I'm talking now with a grower of the bitter greens that Wes was just talking about, Mike Handley, who works with Florabella Farm, which is located up in Three Rivers at the foot of Sequoia National Park. And those rivers come right down right by the farm, and you have this armful of beautiful bitter greens. And talk about this Komatsuna, this one you said is a soft mustard green.
Yeah, so this one has more of a sweet flavor. It's not going to be spicy or pungent, but it does have almost an aftertaste of mustard. Mm-hmm. So it's like a spinach with a mustard flavor.
And then how about these two? You talked about Mizunas, these kind of like a Japanese mustard.
So we have two kinds of Mizuna. One's called Red Rain, and it's just a beautiful dark green with a light green underneath it and red veins. So that would be a raw in a salad. And the other Mizuna is kind of looks like lacy almost. And both of these are going to have a mustardy flavor, but you can eat them raw or steam them or wilt them. Mm-hmm. And on the mustard side, we have a couple other flavors too on the spicier side. One is the wasabina, and the other one is the red mustard, which will tickle the back of your nose when you eat it raw. And if you steam that one or wilt it, it's a nice spicy, but not too strong.
Do they get a little less intense when they're cooked?
Yes. Yeah, the cooking takes out some of the spicy or the pungent.
And you grow right there at the foothills of Sequoia National Park, and I know those rivers come down, but then when it gets really dry, there's no water. So how does the farm kind of adapt to the seasons?
Right. So we're all off of snowmelt. We do have two reservoirs that we fill up seasonally. And I learned something really amazing about our foothills. We're right at the base of the sequoias, which is about 7,000 vertical feet of mountains. So in September every year, our farmer has learned that when the trees go dormant, they stop sucking the water up and a bunch of water gets released down to the spring, which recharges the river before the rains come and recharges our ponds before even the winter rains come. So we were set for the winter, and then the rains came, and now we're super set.
I see. Yeah, and now these, all these beautiful greens, it looks like they are just thriving. They're at their peak right now.
Yeah, the farm is incredibly beautiful with all these greens growing on it right now.
Okay, and then are these in production right now? They'll be here all winter long. Do you plant them over the summer, too, or does it get too hot?
It's too hot to grow lettuces and greens where we are in the summer. Mm-hmm. So this is a fall, winter, spring product for us. And it'll be going throughout the winter.
And how do the deer like them?
The deer love them. Yeah, the deer love everything up there. I saw a beautiful coyote coming out of the farm the other morning, and the deer somehow get through the fence. They're around.
Yeah. Okay, so a little bit for the deer and a little bit for us.
Yeah, little for the deers, little for us.
Okay. All right, Mike. Well, it just looks absolutely lush, and it's so great to see you guys having such a great year up there this year.
Thank you.
That was Mike Handley, and he works up at Three Rivers Farm with James and Dawn Birch of Florabella, and it's all about the greens at this time of year. Starting out January 2017, we'll have a nice, healthy spring. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
It's been 5 months since Chef David Schlosser opened his Capo-style restaurant, Shibumi, in downtown L.A. In October, Jonathan Gold ranked it number 2 in his 101 Best Restaurants L.A. Times listicle. That's high praise for a new restaurant. So, David, how did that make you feel?
It's quite overwhelming, something not expected at all. So we had to kind of take it in a very humble way, keep our heads down, and not to believe the hype too much, because we need to stick it out, and it's about the long run here. LA is famous for trends, and hot or not, you know. So yeah, I need to kind of focus on that and make sure that we're hot in 2.5 years from now.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to be celebrating, not now.
The long game.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're no stranger to our restaurant scene here. You worked previously under Ludo Lefebvre at L'Orangerie.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in France during the 90s, before mm-hmm. becoming enamored with Japanese cuisine. So mm-hmm. what was it that changed your trajectory?
At the time, I mean, I was always trying to open a French restaurant in which I had a little layover in Japan, and completely struck me off guard, in which everything that was going on there, I completely related to and connected to in so many levels. It caused me to rethink the future and dive deep into the hidden worlds of Japan.
So we're more familiar with the casual izakaya style and also the elaborate kaiseki form of seasonal Japanese cuisine. So how does Capo Ryori differ from either of those two?
Capo Ryori is really interesting, in which it takes certain casualness of izakaya, yet with very structured rules of kaiseki. I thought it was great for LA because it puts us in its place, yet not as too formal like a kaiseki, which I know LA has kind of veered away from the super high formality of restaurants. But there's a real structure there that I thought would be great and eye-lifting for the people here.
Seasonality must play into that as well.
Japan is, it's really, they celebrate the seasons. They have decorations for each season. You know, let's say fall comes and there's certain ingredients that you actually have to put on the menu. Otherwise, you're just sleeping. Lily bulbs, I mean, one of the most fascinating ingredients in the world, comes out in December. You're not going to put that on the menu. You're going to have to wait till next December then. It's just like, why wouldn't you put that on? So put it on. With the matsutake mushroom, the most famous mushroom in Japan. And that's coming out in October, November, a little bit of December. So that's on the menu currently.
You source your ingredients from Chino Farms, one of my favorite families in the world, a third-generation Japanese-American-owned farm down near San Diego that famously Alice Waters, I think her devotion to them is what put them on the map a bit. What is it about their produce, their fruits and vegetables, that makes it such a pleasure?
Chino Farm is at such another level. I grew up in Santa Monica before the whole Santa Monica Farmers Market phase was cool. So I've been seeing these farmers markets for 20-plus years. So I've seen high quality, and I'm very proud to be in Southern California and have these beautiful farmers markets. Yet, with this perspective, you go down to Rancho Santa Fe and you go see the farm. It's at a very different level. And I don't even think there's a question about it. See, the thing is, if you go to a farmer's market, let's say on Wednesdays in Santa Monica, you have farmers that specialize in probably 5 to 8 vegetables or fruits. And they do it very well, and they spend many years making these beautiful products. You go down to Chino in April, they don't have 8 ingredients. They have 40, maybe 50 different varieties. Farmer markets, they don't have 50 varieties. That sounds like a supermarket to me. So how do you get to that point? Well, they're really good. They've been doing it also for, I don't know, 70 years-ish,
80 super years. Inquisitive intellectually.
Yeah. How are you able to perfect so many vegetables? They constantly have interns coming from Japan, farmers, flying over, learning how they're doing things. I brought a chef once from Tokyo, and she said to me, this is so unbelievable because when you go to Japan, the vegetables are so clean and perfect, yet they have this wateriness where Chino, it's just as perfect and beautiful, yet you actually taste more of the essence of the vegetable itself. And she was just blown away.
I understand that for Japanese, New Year's is a major food holiday, above all else, celebrated with family. Can you speak a little bit to what some of those food traditions are, and there must be symbolism behind them?
Yeah. Well, Osechi Ryori, or Osechi, the New Year's, Oshogatsu, is the biggest holiday of the year. There's less champagne and partying with your buddies, and it's more of a gathering for your family. It's also kind of like a Japanese Shabbat, in which you don't cook food after midnight for that day. You're supposed to just relax, have the food pre-prepared the night prior, just relax with your family for the first couple days.
What a good way to start the year.
But yeah, I mean, when you have these foods, it's, you know, there's a lot of symbolism involved, like soba. People are eating soba on New Year's, and the long noodles represents having a long life. Or you're also supposed to be eating black beans, which means like mame, kuromame. Mame means like hard, strong, having a healthy life in the future. So you eat your black beans.
Chef David Schlosser's new restaurant is Shibumi. Go to our blog to see more Japanese food traditionally eaten during the first week of the new year. The address is blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, we travel to the Silk Road. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
Samarkand, so it lies to the east of Uzbekistan. So that's above Afghanistan, below Kazakhstan. And it's really the heart of Central Asia.
That's food and travel writer Caroline Eden talking about Samarkand. She says the city's cuisine is a bit like matryoshkas, the Russian nesting dolls. As soon as you unveil one thing, something else reveals itself.
It dates back a long time. It's founded around the 5th century BC, and it's occupied a key position on the trade routes of Central Asia for a really long time. Between the 6th and the 13th century was really its zenith. And a lot of that kind of history remains there today. So these wonderful madrasas and squares that you find there were really sort of built in the 14th century when Tamerlane had it as his capital. And these rulers knew what they were doing because they arrived and they sort of claimed Samarkand as their own, really because of the climate that you find there, which is almost Mediterranean. It's quite warm in the summer, cool in the winter, meaning it's very fertile. So there's pasture land and irrigation channels. So its position has really contributed to the success of the city over the years.
And describe, I guess, the size of it. Give us a sense of the activity when you first came. Were you welcomed or did you feel extremely foreign?
It's relatively large. You've got quite a lot of Soviet buildings on the outskirts, sort of urban sprawl, for lack of a better term. But the historical centre is quite compact, and you can walk around most of it. And when you arrive, you do feel quite foreign. Even today, it's not very touristy. So you stand out a little bit, but you're not stared at. You're not sort of intimidated at all. They are quite used to foreigners visiting. You see the odd tour bus. They're very, very welcoming, the Uzbeks. Hospitality in Uzbekistan is really, really valued. So hostility is not something I've ever encountered anywhere in Uzbekistan.
So aside from the Uzbeks, what are the other ethnic groups that have left their mark on the region in general?
For the book, I picked out 7 groups that have influenced the culture of Samarkand, really just for the purposes of the book. There are many more. First of all, obviously the Uzbeks themselves, famous for Central Asian pilafs, rice dishes and shashliks. Then the Tajiks, who are just across the border, who have lived for centuries in Samarkand. They're kind of number 2. Large numbers of them are still there in Samarkand today. Thirdly, the Russians. A large population of ethnic Russians still live in post-Soviet Central Asia. Generally speaking, their contribution has sort of included borscht and piroshki, you know, the filled buns and vodka. The 4th obvious group that we had to include are the Turks, who have traded and lived in the region for centuries. And it's interesting today that the sort of trendy modern restaurants you tend to find through Uzbekistan are Turkish. Like, people love spitted grilled lambs and kebabs. The 5th group is small but significant. It's the Jewish population. It's sort of believed that they first arrived with Tamerlane. As he was sort of conquering lands in the 14th century, he brought Jewish dyers and weavers from the Middle East back to Samarkand, his capital. And while most Jews today have either left for Israel or New York, mainly living in Queens, around 1,000 have remained, and they've guarded their culinary traditions quite well. 6th group, we're nearly there, are people from the Caucasus. So that's the Armenians, Azeris and Georgians, who during the Soviet Union travelled in small numbers and settled a little bit in Uzbekistan. And then lastly, and perhaps the least predictably, are the Koreans. I was keen to include the Koreans because there is a Korean diaspora. They're known locally as the Koro Saram, and they arrived to Uzbekistan when Stalin deported them during the Second World War. And they stayed on, and they're quite recognisable in the markets where they sort of tend to sell their spicy carrot salads and pickled cucumbers.
It's fascinating because here in Los Angeles, we used to use the term melting pot a lot. I would imagine that these groups don't necessarily melt, but there must be a lot of culinary jostling.
That's right. I mean, melting pot has become a bit of a cliche, hasn't it? But it really can be applied to Samarkand. I mean, we could have included more groups, but 7 is probably enough. And they were the most interesting and important 7 to include.
So aside from stories and recipes in the book, there are a great many photographs, which really give you sort of the texture of the area, so much color. It would be great if you could just start with that Korean carrot salad and describe how the Koreans living in the area have adapted kimchi into a different kind of dish.
Okay, it's quite interesting because the Koreans are really the only people that like heat and sort of proper heat that we understand it in Central Asia. Central Asian food does not have a lot of spice to it generally. You might find a little bit of cumin, coriander, maybe some turmeric, a dash of Turkish chili or Aleppo pepper, but delicate. Whereas the Koreans, in their spicy carrot salads, and that's literally just grated carrots with vinegar and a lot of chilies in it, that is the quintessential salad. And they spin it up into these plastic bags and people take it away for lunch.
I think a lot of us are familiar with pomegranates and tart apricots and nuts in the region, but there's also a wealth of apples.
Yes.
And they're quite important there. Could you talk about how they became so prolific?
I couldn't do this book without talking about the apples in Kazakhstan. So while I've just mentioned my 7 ethnic groups, I didn't mention the Kazakhs, but we have got an essay in the book which I wrote about Kazakhstan's apples, and it's because it's so interesting and it's a neighbouring country. it's really the only place in the world where apples grow as a forest. Near the border of China, there are literally virgin forests where wild apples grow over thousands of acres. In the former capital, Almaty, it's sort of named after the apple. Almaty literally means father of apples in Kazakh. No one's really sure how the apple sort of formed there, but it's believed that thousands of years ago, a seed, which was kind of the early ancestor of apples as we know them today, was transported by birds from China into the isolated Tian Shan mountain range in Kazakhstan. This mountain range spans several countries, but and that was where it started to slowly evolve into the kind of apples that we're familiar with today. And lots of scientists do believe that that is where the apple comes from, which is quite remarkable.
The variety must be staggering, since in a wild forest, every single seed would birth a completely different tree.
That's right.
Mulberries. You know, we get mulberries here in the Southern California markets. Could you sort of speak to the ubiquity of them in the region and how they're most commonly eaten?
We have an entire essay in the book called The Importance of Mulberries Throughout Central Asia. People sort of await mulberry season a bit like how we English people await the asparagus season. It's really sort of looked forward to. And it goes into drinks, it goes into puddings, it goes into all kinds of different dishes depending on the region.
Are they mostly used fresh, or is there also a role for them dried?
They're generally used fresh, but because they're so rich in vitamins and antioxidants, they're also dried. And this is especially the case in mountainous countries like Tajikistan and Afghanistan, where people need to get through a very tough winter. They perhaps haven't got access to markets if they're living in mountainous areas. And they'll literally boil it into a syrup and then dry it into these fruit leathers, which you tend to find throughout the region. And it's a portable means of kind of carrying something to sustain them through the extreme winters.
I can't even imagine having enough mulberries that you could boil them and make a fruit.
It's remarkable, isn't it? I've heard that in some places they literally hold sheets under the trees and shake them and they just fall down into these bed sheets. I haven't witnessed that, but I would love to.
One of the institutions that kind of fascinates me are the chaikanas. Could you describe what they are and their historical usage and what they're like now?
Yes, of course. I'm a big fan of the chaikana, even though I'm a woman. Chaikanas are traditionally very male throughout the region. But if you're a foreign tourist, they're kind of okay with you to go in and have a look. So from Kabul to Khiva, the chaikana is a meeting place. It's as important to some people as the mosque, dare I say, because each village or town, while it will have a mosque, it will certainly have a chaikana as well. Every settlement in the region will have both. People will sit there and they'll drink tea. They'll talk about sort of their current affairs, politics, all these different important things. And they'll be back and forth to the samovar, the self-boiler, filling up their teacups and sort of putting the world to rights. It's a really important place in Central Asian culture.
Is there any kind of food served?
Very basic food. I mean, literally nowadays, possibly a biscuit or some dried nuts, but it's all about the tea. It's about green and black tea. So that's your choice.
Caroline Eden's new book is called Samarkand, Recipes and Stories from Central Asia and the Caucasus. She wrote it with Eleanor Ford. Say Persia and an expansive understanding of an ancient gastroculture, including many lands and peoples, comes into focus. Food writer-photographer Naomi Duguid spent years exploring these lands bound by tradition and custom. Her new work, Taste of Persia, is a compelling look at this area. Could you sort of just take us through the idea you had originally when you made the decision to take a look at this expansive idea of Persia as a region rather than focus on these separate regional cultures?
You know, I always am trying in the books. I mean, my political agenda that I don't try and wear on my sleeve, but is really one of the things that drives me, is to sort of make the other, whether it's other because it's far away or because it's just unknown or because it's scary, to make the other less other. The notion of exotic, or that horrible word ethnic, to sort of eliminate those and just try and connect with people at the kitchen, at the human level. So one of the things I wanted to do was write about Iran and about Persian culture because it's so rich and so it's been so generous to the rest of the world culinarily. But I'm not Persian. So it's not up to me to write the definitive book about Persian cuisine or Iranian cuisine. But I am familiar with the rest of the region, and I wanted to cross-connect it because, of course, as you know, cuisines don't respect borders, and nor does culture, and that's a good thing. And so people will come back from, say, Georgia in the Caucasus and say, wow, the food was so amazing. And they don't necessarily have any idea, and nor do the Georgians, that there's a cross-connection, there's a cousinage between, say, Georgian food and Iranian food. And the Persians don't know this either. And so it seemed to me I can contextualize. I'm an outsider to all of it. I'm a foreigner to all of it. And I think it is a very strong culinary region and a strong idea. The only reason it seems, I think, perhaps new is because those places have been separated from each other and from us by unbelievably difficult political borders. And, you know, ideological borders, right? That, you know, the Caucasus countries were in the Soviet Union. And, you know, where was that? And now they've emerged. And Iran has been behind this wall of headlines of Ayatollahs and revolutions and invective. And the Kurds in Iraq have been behind a wall of Saddam Hussein, war, geography, all sorts of things. And they need to be thought of together. There is a cousinage in the food. And I'm sure you could see as you read through the recipes, even before you cook anything or read much, how cross-connected they are.
Let's talk about the countries that you travel through.
Well, I guess starting from the north, there's the wall of the Caucasus Mountains that separates the Caucasus countries from Russia. And then below that wall of Caucasus Mountains is Georgia, which has a Black Sea coast. And next to it, Azerbaijan, that has a Caspian Sea coast. And then sort of south of Georgia and Azerbaijan is what's left of what used to be a huge country, Armenia, and is now a small republic. And then south of Armenia is the large sort of heart-shaped lump that is Iran, which has a coast on the Caspian and then a coast on the Indian Ocean. And then on the left side of Iran, on the western edge of Iran in the hills, is the Kurdish part of Iraq.
And then talking about this region as peoples, you have Iran, which is neither Arab nor Turkic.
That's right. And that's such an important thing. It's not, you know, this term Middle Eastern, which I also don't like, but it's not that. It's Persian. So that language, Persian, is written, which has influenced, influenced Urdu, is an Iranic language. It's written in an Arabic script. Then there's Georgian, which is written in Georgian script and is entirely a language in its own language family, Kartvelian languages. Then there's Armenian, which is an old Indo-European language, has its own script. And then there's Kurdish, which is an Iranic language. And then there's Azeri, which is a Turkic language, but it has lots of Persian words in it because the inhabitants of the area were Persian speakers of some kind, and then the Turkish invasions that came across Azerbaijan, you know, kind of changed the language, but there are remnants of the earlier languages. It's a pretty exciting place if you're interested in language at all.
And in fact, you met some Assyrians who still speak Aramaic.
Oh, and then there's Aramaic. Oh, yes. I mean, you know, it's an extraordinary thing. You know, I thought Aramaic was, you know, a language of the Old Testament and a language of the Bible. And here's Aramaic written in signs in Kurdistan and people using it in their churches.
Incredible.
And in their villages.
So let's talk about the food. Is sour one of the flavors that ties the region together?
Well, I think sour is everywhere. But I think tart fruits, sour from what is the question, I think. And instead of being, I mean, there is some sour from citrus, but it's really mostly sour from tart pomegranates as opposed to sweet ones, tart dried apricots, barberries, which are kind of a small, if you're in a Persian grocery store, they look like kind of slightly reddish raisins, and they're tart tasting and fabulous. And then the usual, you know, there's verjuice and vinegar and so on, and some tamarind in southern Iran. So that tart fruit in savory dishes is a huge thing that connects the region. That and I think in the use of fresh herbs on the table, fresh herbs in cooking and also on the table, is a real kind of, it's a leitmotif, it's throughout. And it's a lovely, lovely habit to get into.
So give me an example of like the tart dried apricots that are used in a dish.
There's an Armenian soup that is really, to me, tastes like, I don't know, the beginning of civilization or something, because it's so plain on the page and so kind of resonant in your mouth. And it's made with emmer, which is an early wheat, you know, a reminder that we're near the cradle of civilization, the Tigris and Euphrates, and some onion. You can put potato in it, but I like to keep it really, when I'm going to be spare, I'm going to be really spare. So just onion and the emmer wheat, you can substitute a soft wheat, just a whole wheat berry, and then dried apricots. And you cook them in water, and the water gets flavored, the broth gets flavored with the apricots and with the onion. And there's just this, and the taste of the grain, it's just fabulous. You can put some black pepper in it if you want to be jazzy, you know, as well as salt. That's about it. And then eat it with fresh herbs. And you can put a dollop of good thick yogurt in it if you want to swirl it around. But it's just astonishing. And it's so much more than the sum of its parts. That's the thing that's so interesting about this food.
So yogurt. Talk to me about yogurt as a glue.
Well, yogurt is really... It's so interesting. If you think about the region, especially the Kurds and the Kurds and the Azeris, the Turkic peoples, they were nomadic originally. And if you think about nomads, they've got herds, and that means they're eating meat and milk products. So I don't know how yogurt first originated, and I'm sure everybody claims it. But if you have, as the Georgians, well, as everybody does in the region, if there are herds in the mountains providing you with meat, they're also making milk. And so you have fresh cheeses in Georgia and Armenia that are used sort of sprinkled on things and used almost as a condiment, an extra thing, and also in Kurdistan. And then you have yogurt, and the yogurt's usually thick and very fresh, and people make it at home. And again, it's sort of, it's an extra dollop. You use it as a condiment, but you can also use it as a drink. So people dilute it with, you know, 50-50 water or maybe soda water and yogurt, and then put a pinch of salt in, or they can put sweet in, might put a pinch of cumin. So you can think, well, that's kind of like a lassi from the Indian subcontinent. Yeah, it's related. It's called doogh in most of the languages of the area. And then you can also use it to make soup. And there's a fabulous yogurt soup. So I'm back to soup again. Well, but there's a fabulous yogurt soup that you find throughout the region, small variations in it, but it's basically yogurt thickened with a tiny bit of flour, and there's an egg, and then lots and lots of chopped fresh herbs. And it just, again, you know, how many ingredients did I mention? And it's so much greater than the sum of its parts. And the one I included in the book is an Azeri one from Azerbaijan. And when I was in a homestay, and the person, woman making it, made it, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then she took some powdered cinnamon and sprinkled it in a sort of cross on the top. This is a Muslim woman. This is not about religion. This is just about geometry. Sprinkled a cross of powdered cinnamon across the serving bowl of the soup. And this thing happens when you stir that cinnamon into the yogurt soup. And it's so unexpected. It just turns it into a whole other thing. You know, strange. Can you visualize that in your mind's palate, if you know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely.
It's really something. It's like the sort of a little pinch of clove in a sauce sometimes. It just does a thing to it. It's wonderful.
Throughout your travels, you had quite a few experiences of being passed on to the next person or coming upon people who offered you extraordinary kinds of hospitality. Could you speak to particularly the Caucasus and this hospitality that you encountered?
It's really an extraordinary thing. I ran into it in Iran. You know, people would meet me, run into me and start talking to me because I'm visibly foreign, not because of how I look, but because I don't wear a headscarf very elegantly and I don't wear makeup. And anyway, I'm just a little disheveled. So I don't pass as Persian in Iran at all. And so people would come up and speak to me in English and invite me and talk to me. And then we might go for tea, or I might get invited to an apartment. But in the Caucasus, in the villages, there was this whole other level of kind of informal warmth. And so I was walking down a lane in a little Armenian village called Tatev. And I was there because it's also a tourist place. There's a fabulous old monastery there. And these guys saw me through the wind, the doorway of their courtyard, and, you know, came out and sort of grabbed, one of them grabbed my arm and said, you know, said to me in Armenian, but I understood he was inviting me in. And so I went into the courtyard, and there was a whole family gathered there. The grandmother was, or great grandmother, actually, she probably was preserving tomatoes. And these guys were offering me tutovka. And tutovka is a, you know, is a vodka made of, or a hooch made of mulberries. But that same kind of thing happened to me in Azerbaijan as well. And I think it's, there's just this, I write about this welcoming of the stranger. It's extraordinary to me in a place that's had conflict and, you know, Soviet oppression. It's a wonderful, you become an insider. And when you're an insider, then the warmth at the hearth is, and in the heart, is extraordinary. And the trick is, as the outsider being welcomed in, is how to accept that generosity without embarrassment, you know, just sort of gratefully and openly, because they're being open with you. The pressure is sort of on you as the recipient to, on me in this case, as a recipient to just enjoy and be as open with them. And that's, I mean, it's a lovely challenge, but it's very interesting because we don't experience that so much here. It's made me think a lot about, you know, human relationships and what might be missing in our daily life, especially if we're listening to and looking at our devices instead of being attentive to each other, you know.
You were in Iran during the saffron harvest in late October.
Yes.
Could you describe what you saw?
Well, you know, there's a long story in there about searching for it, because it sort of was one of those things. It's kind of like that podcast serial, Are We Ever Going to Get to the End of It? You know, where's the saffron? It grows in the fall. The saffron is the stigmas of a crocus. Crocus is a pale purple. And I had sort of thought, well, are there going to be fields of purple crocuses? Certainly not where I was. The crocus bulbs are in the ground and they go on giving for 7 or 8 years. And how the whole thing starts is, as the temperature cools in late September, early October, the villagers water them. And then 3 weeks later, they water them a second time. And that kind of stimulates the bulb into producing a flower. And the flower is picked first thing in the morning at dawn. And then the bulbs may flower again, or other ones may flower late in the afternoon. And that's when I came across them. So there's this dirt, just brown dirt. And then every once in a while, these mauve flowers, which you have to sort of bend over to see. And then the brilliant, extraordinary red, orange, kind of red, really deep reddish colored, persimmon colored stigmas. Just stunning, but so precious. I mean, those flowers get picked, and then village women pick the stigmas out of each flower. And then some other middleman takes them and then sells them to some other person. And so by the time they even get to Mashhad in Iran, they've got a lot of people's labor and attention invested in them.
And what was the food that you had that used the saffron?
Well, anything that it's mostly in Iran and in Azerbaijan that I had saffron in food, and it would be in rice, especially, you know, any kind of polo rice, you know, you put a little saffron water. There's saffron water on the cover of the book. You put some saffron threads in warm water and they stain the water beautifully. They color it. And then you use that water to color the rice. And it's a sign of, it's kind of a richness. It's a generosity. In Georgia, there's no saffron. So people use dried marigold petals, and they include that in their spice blend, and they call it saffron. It's the same. They're looking for the same color. They're not getting the same aroma from it. But it's this urge to make things golden and bright. It makes the food special.
Throughout this region, so much of how you're eating involves rice, and it also involves flatbreads. And I think any of these breads would be delicious with your recipe for spinach biryani.
Oh, yes. The spinach biryani is so delicious. You cook the spinach, and, you know, we all have our prejudices about how we like to cook spinach. I like it just with the washing water on it and a skim of oil in a wide skillet. And I like to chop it coarsely and then press it against the skillet and let it cook in its own water at a fairly high heat. And with no lid or anything, I never leave it. I just move it around until it's done. And then take some drained yogurt or thick yogurt, if you have access to Greek yogurt or water buffalo yogurt. You can mix them perfectly, but I like to leave some of the pure green and some of the pure white and sort of make a kind of a swirl. You also stir in some fried onion, and then you sprinkle some walnuts on top. You could use pistachios if you don't like walnuts. And then you can put a little drizzle of saffron water if you want to make it pretty. And it shows up beautifully against the white yogurt.
Naomi Duguid's latest cookbook is Taste of Persia, a cook's travels through Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Iran, and Kurdistan. In a minute, we return to our neck of the woods. Don't go anywhere.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. So far in the show, we've heard about food eaten in Japan, Samarkand, and Iran. Now, let's take a short jaunt up the coast to eat and drink with Allison Costa. She owns Ventura Food Tours and Santa Barbara Tasting Tours. Let's start in Ventura, where I understand that the craft beer scene continues to grow.
Yes, it's definitely a very exciting time to be a beer drinker in Ventura. I've got a few new places to tell you about. One is called Made West. It's got a really nice big tasting room with concrete floors and, you know, warehouse doors that open up to let the sunshine in. A great place to spend a Saturday or Sunday afternoon drinking beer with friends. They pretty much always have a food truck or two parked outside. They've got live music on the weekends. Another place to check out is Topa Topa Brewing Company. They've got a good selection of IPAs. I was in a couple days ago. They usually have about 12 different beers on tap. And when I was there last, they had a really delicious, they call it their Howler Coffee IPA, which really kind of blew me away. I love IPAs and I love, you know, a coffee stout. And this was kind of the best of both worlds. You wouldn't normally think that kind of the citrus flavor of an IPA would work well with the flavor of coffee, but they nailed it. It's a really, really interesting beer, really fun to drink. Another favorite there is their Tux Milk Stout on Nitro. So it's got a really smooth mouthfeel. I was drinking this beer and thinking, gosh, this is so good. And look up at the board and they kind of have the tasting notes to give you an idea of the flavor profile. And it says chocolate, macadamia nut, and cake batter. I was like, oh, that's why I love this beer. I have a sweet tooth, but this beer is not too sweet. It's definitely one of my favorite beers to drink right now.
So let's talk about food, and let's go to Oxnard. Where have you been eating there?
My new favorite place in Oxnard is Brasserie Communautaire. It's a fairly new place, and I kind of can't get enough of it. They're open for dinner pretty much every night of the week, and then they do a wonderful brunch on Sunday. This is one of those places where just reading the menu is exciting. They change it on a weekly basis, all, you know, focused on seasonal local ingredients, and their brunch is really fun. It's a fixed menu, four courses, and I was amazed at how much I enjoyed not having to make a single decision during the meal. We sat down, and all we had to decide on was coffee or bottomless mimosas or both. So they just kept bringing out course after course, really fun, inspired dishes. They did an oatmeal rice pudding to start, deviled eggs with bacon jam, biscuits, shrimp and grits, smoked ham hash with a duck fat fried egg. And then they finished the whole thing with dessert. I was like, dessert with brunch? And their dinners are great as well.
So now we're going to head inland a bit to Ojai.
Yes.
What's happening there?
Lots of great things happening in Ojai. A new location of Beacon Coffee, a coffee company based out of Ventura. They took over an old Caro's building and spent months remodeling it and created this beautiful, bright, open, sunny, modern space, a great place to take your laptop and work for a couple hours or just grab a coffee to go. I'm kind of obsessed with two things there right now. That could always change, but for now, my obsessions are, first of all, they're flat white coffee drink. And I know if you're like me, when Starbucks came out with the flat white, I didn't really understand what a flat white was. I don't even know if I still understand it or if any of us really, really do. What makes theirs unique is that they actually use Strauss Organic half and half instead of milk. And owners John and Jen explained to me that the flat white originated in Australia and New Zealand, and the milk over there is much different from ours, much fresher, and different fat content, different mouthfeel. They found that using the half and half kind of helped match that tasting experience. So it's a really, really decadent, beautiful little espresso drink, and I love to have it with their rosemary shortbread. And Beacon carries their own pastries like cinnamon sugar Pop-Tarts and savory buckwheat hand pies and muffins and scones. And then they also carry a good selection of vegan and gluten-free products from Sun Oven. And I'm not vegan, I'm not gluten-free, and I'm kind of obsessed with the shortbread. First of all, it's a big piece of shortbread, not a little skinny stick of shortbread. It's, you know, a big square, like a big brownie, and thick. And it has just this incredible flavor and this wonderful mouthfeel to it, a really fine crumb, but it holds together when you bite it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty good. And I love that combination of sweet and savory when you're kind of surprised when you're eating something. And it's sweet, but then you've got the overlay of the rosemary flavor, which definitely is a really, really great combination. So definitely worth a drive to Ojai just for that.
So when I think about going up north to your neck of the woods, I think about Mexican food. Is there something in Ojai happening?
Yes. One of the newer Mexican places in Ojai is the Ojai Tortilla House, another very small family-run business. The owner, Nicio, works with his mom and his dad and his brother, and he always laughs that if one of them is sick that they can't open. It's that small of an operation. And as you can guess by the name, they specialize in tortillas. So all handmade tortillas, his mother makes them. And so the menu is very simple, just soft tacos and quesadillas and burritos, anything you can put on one of their tortillas.
Are they making both corn and flour?
Yes, they do. They do. And I like to get their specialty taco, which is made on a rosemary and garlic corn tortilla. And all their salsas are fresh. They finish the tacos with some cabbage and cilantro, little drizzle of sour cream and guacamole. I like to get one of those and one of their agua frescas. The watermelon is my favorite. They have a line from the minute they open every day until the minute they close. Very, very popular and definitely worth waiting in the line for these perfect little tacos that are also a really good value.
Let's close out our crawl with the Grand Dame, Santa Barbara. Where do you recommend that we go?
I would recommend, I mean, you can't go wrong in Santa Barbara. There's so many wonderful places. I'm kind of into the Funk Zone area right now. I'm not sure if you've been there. That's an area in Santa Barbara, kind of down near the beach, where there's probably about 20 different winery tasting rooms in this kind of old industrial neighborhood. A couple places to check out. I absolutely love Moni's Taqueria, a little bit off the beaten path taco stand, kind of casual, like the Ojai Tortilla House. They actually have a few tables though, so you can actually sit and eat there. They are another family-run business, and they make a really good mole chicken that I like to get in their tacos. It's dark and got a little bit of that chocolate in it. They also add a little bit of graham cracker crumbs to kind of thicken their mole. That's their secret ingredient. They also have a really great salsa bar. And when we go there with our tour groups, people are always blown away by they have a pistachio salsa. as well as a peanut salsa. So there's some really, really good tasting to be done there.
Now, what about old school pizza?
Just down the street from Moni's in the Funk Zone is a place called the Lucky Penny. The building happens to be covered in 164,000 pennies. So for looks alone, it's definitely worth checking it out. They have a wood-burning pizza oven and roll out some really, really delicious pizzas. My personal favorite is the one they call the Ode to Dan Russo, and it's made with oven-roasted tomatoes, a pork and fennel sausage, Calabrian chili, smoked mozzarella, and then it's finished on top with a sprinkling of fresh arugula. Their pizza oven runs around 2,000 degrees, so they cook these pizzas really, really fast. So you can imagine kind of the smoky flavor that's already there to begin with and a good amount of char on the thin crust. And then you add in those sweet, sweet tomatoes and the smokiness from the mozzarella. It's a pizza that I can't get enough of.
Let's finish this all out with a little bit of chocolate.
Yes, you can always count on me to have a chocolate for you. I know when I spoke to you last, I think I talked about Chocolates du Calibrasson in Santa Barbara and their salted caramel Buddha. They have another chocolate that I'm currently really into. It's a curry coconut truffle. I think it's kind of a theme here. I tend to like where the sweet and savory come together. And then there's another chocolate shop closer down to the Funk Zone called Chocolate Maya, and they have a lavender eucalyptus truffle. And the chocolatier, Maya, she makes these small batch chocolates by hand. And for the lavender eucalyptus truffle, I think she makes about 120 per batch. And she infuses that chocolate with one eucalyptus leaf, giving it this really, really interesting flavor. The eucalyptus and the lavender are perfectly balanced with a really dark chocolate. Really divine and definitely worth stopping in there to get one or one of her other chocolates.
Allison, I'm so glad we have you to give us the 411 on what's going on north of us.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Allison Costa owns Ventura Food Tours and Santa Barbara Tasting Tours. Find out where to sign up on the Good Food website to go on one of her tours. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, we hear where our favorite food critic is dining this week. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman.
It's in what almost looks like a blank storefront. And when you're walking by, you may not notice that you've passed it until you see some tables outside that people are at.
That's LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold. Whose restaurant is this?
We're talking about Destroyer, the new restaurant from Jordan Kahn, who we last talked about when he was at, you know, his Beverly Hills restaurant.
Red Medicine.
Right.
Is he open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
He's open for breakfast and lunch. He closes at 3:00, and it's not open weekends. So if you have an actual job that doesn't happen to be in this area, you're probably not going to go here.
So describe the experience of walking up to the counter. What does the place look like? What kind of menu are you ordering off of?
It's a concrete room. The menu is projected white letters on a white wall. So you squint for a while and try to figure out what it is that they actually serve. You order, and they're friendly enough, but they're sort of not into explaining things, which means that you see something on the menu that says, you know, beef tartare, smoked egg, cream, radish. You sort of think you know what it is, but then when you get the plate, it looks like this actually gorgeous bowl of thinly sliced transparent radishes. It's almost like a radish sculpture. And it's not until you dig underneath that you're going to come up with the smoky cream and with little bits of pickled tiny mushrooms like enokis and the meat, which is interestingly seasoned.
He's into the layers.
He's into layers. And so when you order that and it looks like a vegetarian dish from a restaurant in, you know, Sweden or Copenhagen, and the steak is less like steak tartare than it is like some Nordic version of Lebanese kibinaya.
The guy has chops.
He definitely has chops. You know, if you're vegetarian or vegan, it's very possible to eat well. You know, you get roasted beets and it actually looks on the plate as if they're being chased by sesame seeds and pumpkin seeds and other seeds. You get the chicken confit, which may be the only thing on the menu that you actually recognize. And you're served what looks like a Caesar salad. And then you sort of dig beneath the leaves. And then there's a layer of yogurt. There's a layer of toasted hazelnuts. And there's this chicken, which is like as totally rich as you would expect, like something that's been poached in fat to be. And a little pool of brown butter vinaigrette underneath.
I find his dishes to be really made for just sticking your fork all the way through and then bringing it up.
Well, I think there's an actual grammar to it, right? I mean, there's a specific succession, you know, leaves on top, then there's vegetables, then there's something that's crunchy, bread or seeds or something like that. There's always some sort of rich, fluidy thing like fresh cheese or poached egg or that cream or pumpkin butter.
One thing that I was puzzled by, it's in this area where there are a huge number of people working. And so you think, oh, he must do a huge to-go business. But then I started to think about the way those dishes are constructed and how they would look in a to-go container.
But actually, the to-go containers are beautifully composed.
And also, you know, if you follow him on social media, you become aware that he sort of has this fascination with space, outer space. And so I found the repeating theme of the orb kind of delightful.
That's right. There are a lot of orbs.
There are a lot of orbs.
You're cracking things open all the time. I really love the dish of baby potatoes in sort of a brown butter emulsion. A plate full of orbs.
Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is talking about Destroyer in Culver City. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That is it for the first show of the new year. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. They are
Abby Fentress-Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby, here's mine.
Camellia Say,
Joel Stein,
and Ronnie Mickelson.
And of course, I'm Evan Kleinman. I'll be back with you next week with more Good Food.